place and time that I can soon find out what it is. So we're very, very fortunate to have, hopefully it's ready next hour or so, maybe a little bit longer, Professor Lee Smolin. And just to introduce him, he is one of the founding members of Perimeter Institute. So he's been here right from the very beginning in 1999 and seen it grow from a very small place where there was five or six scientists involved to the large building that we have now. And so he's played an integral part in actually kind of building and designing and growing it from a little seed to where it is today. So he does research in a lot of areas, perhaps more known for work in quantum gravity. And heard a little bit about loop quantum gravity. And in the 1980s, Lee was one of the co-discoverers of that. He also does looking at a wide range of areas. And also he does actually a lot of popularization of science. So some of you may have actually read his books. Have any of you read either So The Life of the Cosmos was the first one, and then Three Rows of Quantum Gravity? Has anyone read either of those?
Wow.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
And also if you read Scientific American articles by Discover magazine, Lee is often called on to write articles and notes, so it's very skilled at doing that. So without any further ado, it's a fantastic speaker always. So I'd like to introduce you to Lee.
Thank
Smolin.
So it's very, very nice to speak to you. And this is always fun. We've done this for several years now. And they're always nice enough to ask me to do one of these talks. Is the sound okay? I feel like it's a little loud.
It's a bit soft. Actually.
It's a bit soft. Okay, good. I can speak louder. I haven't planned much. I did bring some graphics, depending on which way I go. But I found these things work best if we do them spontaneously. I could do two kinds of things or some combination of them. So one of them is sort of what's it like to be a scientist, to be in physics, what do I like about it, what do I not like about it. I can tell you a little bit about my story, which is not a typical story, but then again, that many of the people in science don't have typical stories for how they got there. And then I was thinking that I would say something about quantum gravity, which is, of course, one of the sort of four or five key big problems, unsolved problems in physics. But I realized Fotini is also going to be talking about quantum gravity. And a lot of my thinking comes from her thinking, so you don't need to hear it twice. So maybe I'll talk about another aspect of gravity, which may or may not have to do with quantum gravity, but which is an experimental or an observational puzzle connected with gravity that's driving, keeping some of us up nights and waking us up in the middle of the night. Does that sound okay? I'm happy to be interrupted by questions. I'm happy to be informal. So I don't know if anybody has any questions. And also, I understand some of you come from all over the world, which is very representative of science, because indeed, science is now completely international. Thing, which is one of the really nice things about it, is working with and knowing people from all over the world. But an aspect of that is that my colloquial New York English may get past some of you. So if I speak too fast or too much slang, somebody just don't be afraid, just tell me and slow me down. Of course, some people speak English much faster than I do, in which case, Okay, so does that sound fine? So I can sort of start my story at your stage, so when I was in high school, I wasn't much interested in physics in high school. And in fact, I never took physics in high school. I was mostly interested in rock and roll, and mostly my ambition was to be in rock and roll, and I spent a lot of time in playing in bands and so forth. But I was studying math, and I was studying math because of an unfortunate thing that happened, which may have happened to some of you, which is that I wasn't a very disciplined student, and my grades were not very good. So there was a certain point when the school decided which kids could go into which tracks, and I got this piece of paper saying that I could go into the advanced track in English or in math, but not both, and not in physics, not in chemistry, not in biology. Because my grades weren't very good, and that was their estimation anyway. My parents had a friend who was a mathematician and a math professor at a small college nearby. His name is Bill Larkin. And he had actually already played a role in my life because I had been a kind of experimental subject. So this was the days when computers were just starting to be installed in universities. And you know, a computer much less powerful than the one in a phone now, you know, took up a room this size with lots of cooling equipment and so forth. And he had this idea that I was 11 at the time, and he had this idea that kids could program computers, which of course, I mean, I imagine a lot of you program computers. It's not having doing so. It's actually not a big deal. At that time, it was considered, you know, how could a kid program a computer? So he gave me some manuals in Fortran, which is what there was then. And an embarrassing fact, by the way, one of the questions that you all who are interested in computers should ask is why there isn't more progress in computers and computer science. That is, there's this ridiculous thing in which, like, the really cool people use Unix, which was, like, invented before I was born. Right? So, like, where's that? I mean, what, you know, why? There's a certain thing that's frozen. I mean, people, you know, John von Neumann invented basic digital computer architecture in the 1940s to help build nuclear weapons. And it hasn't changed since then, which is bizarre. And the thing that you all ought to wonder about. And you all, I mean, if you want to be in science or technology or anything like that, you should be looking for opportunities of things that people think can't change, but obviously could change. Because over time, that's what keeps happening, is people discover these things that nobody else thought of. And there certainly must be opportunities in reinventing computers. Because you all still study Fortran, right? No? Oh, cool. What are you studying? C.
Java.
Okay.
C.
Basic. Good. Okay, so I'll put it my place. I know C. I can program in C.
C++.
I did C++. Anyway, so I haven't stuck with computers, as you can see. But I was given this chance to do a demonstration, and I did. I wrote some programs when I was 11, and it got in the newspapers. And that was considered like a cool thing. But even so, the high school didn't think I could do advanced math. So he made a proposal to me that I was in ninth grade then. And I don't know if that translates to different things in different countries, but that's sort of 3 years before graduation. And there's 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And he suggested that over the summer I take algebra and trigonometry at his college, at his university, and then if I could do that, he would convinced the school to enroll me in calculus, which was the end of the advanced section. It should have been my last year for next year. And I was sufficiently rebellious that I just did that out of spite, because I wanted to show the school that their methods of testing were bad. And so I did that, and I learned calculus a bit early. At least for Americans, I know in other parts of the world, people study calculus early as a normal thing, normal compared to Americans. And then I sort of kept studying math, but I wasn't interested really in any deep way in it. And I'm not a mathematician, and I realized pretty quickly, talking with some of my teachers who were mathematicians, that I was not a mathematician. Mathematician is somebody who thinks creatively about the structures of ideas and relationships of ideas to each other. I think sort of creatively on that level, and I'm not that. Then I decided, I changed my ambition, although I always had the rock and roll thing, and still have it. I decided I wanted to be an architect, because I met a very visionary architect called Buckminster Fuller, who I don't know if some of you may have heard of. So I invited him to come give a talk at the high school where I was, and met him, and I was very inspired. So I decided to become an architect, and that meant Buckminster Fuller made buildings by taking curved surfaces and dividing them up into triangles and using the triangles as the structural elements. We call it now triangulating a surface. And he had these domes called geodesic domes that you may still see around. There was a period in the 60s and 70s when really cool people like lived in them and built them, but that didn't last, because actually it's not too convenient living inside a sphere. One from Expo 67 in Montreal. Yeah. So the next summer, I needed a summer job and I couldn't get a summer job. So I decided that I would make a company and design and sell swimming pool covers made out of these domes. And I started to do that, and then I realized that a sphere would never do, because most swimming pools are not squares. And so you need to somehow stretch the sphere to an oblong. And so I started to think about how can you take a sort of, three-dimensional oval shape. I don't remember what that's called, spheroidal. Stretch sphere. How could you divide it up into triangles? So I wrote a computer program to do that, which I was pretty proud of myself. And then my father, who was an engineer, said, but how do you know the thing is going to fall down? Because you stretch it out, it might become weaker. And so I went to this friend who was a mathematician, and I said, how do I figure out whether it's going to fall down if I stretch, triangulate a sphere and stretch it? And he said, oh, you need to use something called tensor calculus. So I went to a library and got a book on tensor calculus, and it was indeed the right math, and I started to learn. And I was very lucky that I learned enough calculus I could learn it. And then, really luckily, I never got any customers. I mean, somebody would call up, and I would go and see them and show them some pictures and so forth, and then they'd never call back. So my business was very unsuccessful, which was very good, because I had no idea how I would actually build one, if anybody contracted me. What I found at the end of that book was a section on general relativity, because the same math, which is the mathematics of curved surfaces, was the basis of general relativity. So I thought that was pretty interesting, and I decided to study general relativity. Meanwhile, I had dropped out of high school, which is sort of another story, but I had gotten bored and disagreeable with my high school, and I had dropped out. And I had started out in a program of sort of creative, a new sort of approach to education, which some teachers were starting, which gave kids a lot of freedom. And I like that, but the freedom that they gave me, they just said, find out where in the community is the knowledge that you want and go figure out how to get it. So I thought about that for about 5 minutes and decided the knowledge I wanted was in the university. So I didn't see why I should be going to high school. So I just started taking classes, just dropping in and going to English classes and history classes and math class. I took a math class because I was trying to figure out the stuff about curved surfaces. And I sort of got hooked on reading about general relativity. And then I went to the library and got a book of essays about Einstein called Albert Einstein, Philosopher, Scientist. And there was an essay there by Einstein himself describing his motivation to be a scientist. And he talked about growing up and being disillusioned. And indeed, he also, not that I want to compare myself, but and only in this way, also had dropped out of high school and actually had spent the year bumming around in the Italian Alps and carrying a copy of Maxwell's book about the theory of electrodynamics, being a sort of vagabond hippie there in the Italian Alps. And eventually he had managed to talk his way back into the educational system. But he described being very disillusioned as a young person with, you know, with militarism, with war, with the chase for money. He said, by the existence of a stomach, people are doomed or imprisoned to spend their life chasing after money and shelter and so forth. And he had this idea that there was this transcendent, beautiful reality sort of out beyond the human reality, which was in the laws of nature. And if I'm becoming a scientist, you could search for that transcendent reality and ennoble yourself. And that was why he became a scientist. So that grabbed me too, that picture. So that day, actually I read that in one sitting, and I was supposed to have a date with this girl in the neighborhood, but she stood me up, so I just kept reading the thing. And decided that I was going to do that. Somehow it just occurred to me. Okay, as I was reading it, first the idea appealed to me. Although actually I have a much more optimistic view of humanity and human beings now than I did then. And I no longer actually buy the stuff of doing science to transcend human reality. I like human reality quite a bit, but that appealed to me a lot at the time, and I just had this instinct that I could do that, even though I had never taken a physics class, because I hadn't been allowed to take physics classes at the high school. But there was both the thing that my grades weren't good enough, and the physics teacher was also a very politically right-wing guy who explicitly forbid me to take any of his classes. Because we had a political disagreement. So I actually didn't know much about physics except I knew general relativity. So I just decided that I could do that. And in that essay, he wrote about problems that he was concerned with, which were the problems in quantum mechanics, what quantum mechanics really meant. You see, he never believed quantum mechanics, as also Schrodinger never believed quantum mechanics, and a lot of other good scientists still, I mean, we use it and it works, but we don't believe it gives a good fundamental description of any nature. We don't believe it's true, we believe it's useful, which is a different thing. Like Newtonian physics is useful, but we know it's not true because it's been superseded by relativity theory. So Einstein thought that he could invent the successor to quantum mechanics, which he never did, but that was always his deepest hope, which is also ironic because Einstein was the first person who clearly understood the need for quantum theory. Because he's the first person who understood the duality between waves and particles, and indeed who understood that light had to be both a wave and a particle. And even so, he never accepted quantum mechanics. So that was the first problem that he wrote about. And the second one was somehow putting together the quantum world with space and time and gravity.
Yeah.
So does that make relativity the only theory that's really fundamentally believed gives a good picture?
And I don't believe relativity either. And this is controversial. I would say most of my friends and colleagues believe quantum mechanics in a way that I don't. And I'm not alone. There's a disagreement. There are people who believe different things. I believe the principles of relativity, both special and general, but I think that they're going to be superseded in quite soon. There are already proposals for superseding them. And the reason is, and maybe I'll let, this is possibly what Fortini will tell you about, so maybe I'll let her do it. I don't believe that space is really continuous. I believe that just like matter is composed of atoms, if you look small enough, there are atoms to space. And therefore, there's a different physics which works down on that scale. Yeah?
I want to ask you why you didn't believe in general relativity.
For that reason.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I think, it works, but I don't believe in the continuum.
It's fine on paper, but not in reality.
It's not a question, I mean, theories are human constructions. They're constructions of that we create out of our creativity, out of our intellect. They're representations of nature. Very few people, and in the past, I mean, like with Newton, people believed in some religious sense that, oh my God, Newtonian physics was exactly the way the world was. And many of us, not everybody, but many of us now view theories as more part of culture. They're creative things that we invent, which capture some aspects of reality, but not totally, at least. There's no evidence that anything that we've ever invented totally captured reality. And there's no reason to think that, you know, people in 1925 were any luckier than any other period that totally captured reality. You should look at this. Being a scientist is an interesting thing because it's both very conservative, that is, you have to be, there are these incredible accomplishments which are worthy of respect, and there are the people who made them which are worthy of respect. And you have to learn, it's like a musical craft or art craft, you have to learn to do the stuff well, which requires a lot of practice and discipline. But at the same time, if you're going to succeed creatively at science, you have to be willing to see it all as being in the past and be a rebel and think to yourself, I can solve these problems that these people in the past could not solve. Because there, at any moment, there's a realm that people agree about. And then there is the frontier, and beyond that is unknown, and people disagree about the unknown. They speculate, they make theories, they argue with each other. And science is that moving edge between what's known and what's unknown. And if you want to be on that edge, you have to be prepared to both look back and respect what's behind you, but look forward and see that there's completely open in front of you. So, and that's it's not one thing, and it's not the other thing. It's the combination of both of them that makes it work together, which is almost a contradiction, but it does work. Okay, another question. Let me change grounds and tell you about something which is on the edge, okay, which I think you all can understand very easily, and keeps us up nights. And it's related to the issue about whether generality. It's a reason to worry about general relativity as well. Okay. Can I assume here that you all have seen Newton's theory of gravity, Newton's laws of motion, and Newton's theory of gravity? Okay. So let me just repeat them. Mass times acceleration, which is a vector, is a force for every particle. If I have, let's think of a galaxy. Okay, so a galaxy, looking top on, is a distribution of matter. Looking edge on, looks something like this. That is, there's a disk, there's a halo. Let me draw it better that way. There's a disk. There's a halo. This is formed of stars, but in the disk is also full of gas and dust. The halo is mostly just full of stars. So this is sort of the top view. There are different kinds of galaxies, but in disk galaxies, the stars are all going around in nearly circular orbits. And actually, the whole thing is embedded in a bigger disk of gas, of mostly hydrogen gas, which goes out about a factor of 10 at least bigger. And the gas is also circulating around. Okay? And then there's other structure. There are these beautiful spiral structures and so forth, which, by the way, are not really understood, although there are different ideas about them. And the velocities of the stars are, does anybody know, there's something like 10 to the minus 5th of the speed of light, I think. So in any case, the speeds are small compared to the speed of light, so you shouldn't need to invoke special relativity. And indeed, you shouldn't need to invoke general relativity either. So Newton's law should be a good approximation to what's going on there. So let's think of what Newton's laws are for a star. Let's think of a star in orbit around a galaxy. Okay? It feels a force coming from the matter inside, right? So it has an acceleration, which is towards the center, right? Have you all done problems with motion?
Yeah.
Okay. I promise not to bore you. There's only going to be 3 minutes of things that you already know. Okay, but this is those 3 minutes, which I need for you to understand. Okay, and what's the force? Okay, to get the force, you sum up over all the other stars, and there's a minus sign because gravity is attractive. There's Newton's constant. There's the mass of that particular star. Should we give the star a name that we're talking about?
Alpha.
Who?
It's
Steamax. Okay. So this is the mass of Steamax. And then there's the mass of some other star. And then it's 1 over the distance squared between Steamax and that other star. Okay? And you sum that up over all the other stars. Okay?
And yeah. What was that, beside the minus, what's that again?
This is a symbol that means sum. Oh, it's a Greek letter, sigma. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking if there's anything wrong. Physicists and mathematicians like to use Greek letters to impress people.
We don't have enough letters in our alphabet. So.
Yeah, is there anybody here who's Greek? Okay. Because there is a problem, which is that the names that we call the Greek letters in science speak are not actually the same as the names that people in Greece use, which is very confusing when Greek scientists come to study somewhere else. So this is a symbol which means add up all of these things, and we're adding them up for all the other stars. Yeah.
But this should not be a vector, sum of vectors, no?
It is a sum of vectors, and I have here the little unit vector pointing between. For every other star, there's a unit vector pointing to that star. Thank you. Okay. So this is the combination of Newton's law of motion and Newton's law of gravity. Okay. And general relativity predicts that to a very good approximation when the densities of matter are not too large and the speeds are small compared with the speed of light, which holds here. So this is what people would predict. Now, let's make it simple. Okay, let's assume as an approximation that CMark here, who's somewhere out here, okay, is outside most of the matter. Okay. If you're outside most of the matter, then there's a result which Newton proved in his book, Principia, which is that you can imagine if there's a distribution of matter which is symmetric and you're outside of it, you can imagine that all that mass is actually just one big mass at the center, which is the mass contained within your radius. So all this can be approximated by saying it's a vector pointing to the center, so I'll call that r hat minus g m of CMark times the mass inside that orbit just divided by 1 over r squared, where r is now the distance of CMark to the center. Okay? Now, that implies something, which is that as you go out, the velocity of the star is falling. And let's think about why that is. So there's a relationship that between the velocity and the acceleration and the distance. Does anybody know what that is? Can somebody remind me what that relationship was? Please?
E squared equals EI squared plus 2AB.
That's actually not the one I'm...
The relationship between the AR and E squared over R.
Is the acceleration. Thank you. Okay? Just from dimensions, velocity is a length over time, so this is a length squared over time squared. R is a length, so this is a length over time squared. And acceleration is a length over time squared. Okay? So does everybody know this or remember this? Okay. So this implies together that v squared over r should be going like the acceleration, which is going, if you're outside of all the matter, okay, like g. Now, notice something. Notice that it's irrelevant what the mass of our friend here is. Okay? It cancels out. And that's a general feature of gravitational interactions. That's related to something called the equivalence principle. Okay? So the acceleration is the same no matter if it's our friend here or a much bigger star. So the acceleration goes like gm over r squared. So that implies that v is falling like 1 over square root of r. Okay? And to be precise, like square root of gm over square root of r, right? That's the prediction. So did I get that right? Because v squared is going like 1 over r. Please?
Yeah, r casts out with r.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So then v squared is like going like 1 over r, so v is like going like 1 over square root of r.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay? So it turns out that, so here's a prediction. Okay, here is distance from the center of a galaxy. And let me graph two things. One of them is the matter density. Okay, so most of the mass of a galaxy is in the center, and then it sort of falls off. So this is sort of the matter density. And then, based on this, you can predict what velocity should a star should have. Well, it should start and build up. Why should it build up? Because there's very little acceleration near the center, because there's very little mass. Well, the only mass that counts if you're going in a circle is the mass inside. Okay, so there's very little acceleration, so there's very little speed. So this I'm graphing here is speed. Okay? And then when you're outside of most of the matter, it should fall off like 1 over square root of r. So this is called a velocity curve. Okay. And that's the prediction. Okay. Now, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, Vera Rubin, who's an American astronomer working at the Carnegie Institute, started to study the velocities of stars in our own solar system. And she did this because for stars near enough, you can actually see that they've moved comparing to old records and old photographic plates. So she really made measurements of the velocities of the stars in our neighborhood. So, in other words, we're somewhere here. We have some velocity around the galaxy. And she could measure the velocities of some stars further away and nearer. And so she did that with some students. And it looks sort of like that. And does anybody comment on? Well, it's not falling. It's not decreasing.
It's constant. It's constant.
Wow.
The velocity of all those stars is constant.
So a rough approximation, what she found is that the stars further out from us and further in from us relative to the center of the galaxy were moving at a roughly the same speed as us. What? We're coming to that. People told her she was a young assistant professor. People told her she was crazy. She hadn't done it right, etc. She kept working out as the things stayed the same. She then talking with a friend one day, and they realized that they could get a good measurement of other galaxies. And here's the idea. The idea is, supposing you see a galaxy sort of not quite edge on, but sort of oriented sort of like this towards you. So you sort of see the disk sort of rotated. Okay? And the stars here, let's say, are moving towards us, and here are moving away from us. And there's a redshift. Okay? Supposing you could put a slit directly across like that. Okay? And take the light, take a telescope, focus on the galaxy, put a slit on the output of the telescope, and take the light from the slit directly into a spectrometer that measures the spectrum. Okay? What should you expect to see? You should expect to see, here's the center of the galaxy, the light on this side. There's an overall redshift from the center because the galaxy is moving away from us. Almost every galaxy is moving away from us. But if you normalize here to the redshift at the center, you should expect to see that this light is bluer. So if this is blue over here and this is redder down here, you would expect to see the line from that slit on the spectrograph look like this. And that. Why? Okay, here it's coming towards us, so it's bluer, but then it's falling off because that's what Newton's gravity theory predicts. Here it's moving away from us, so it's redder. Sorry, it's bluer over here, it's redder over here, and then it falls off. Yeah. Okay. So that's what you should expect to see. Okay? And she did that observation on about a dozen galaxies. I don't remember the exact number, 10, 12 galaxies. And can I, is there another color somewhere? A green one. I'm not sure the green one can be seen. So I'll stick to this. Anyway, what she saw was that. It rises and it's constant. Okay? And the beautiful thing about this observation is that there's no data. There's no big computer analysis of the data. It's not complicated. It's one slit, one photographic plate. Okay? This is one photographic plate that the light has been focused on after the slit in the spectrometer. So it's all there in one image. And there's no processing. Because, you know, the more you process data, the more errors can come in. Okay. And she and her students did this first time about a dozen galaxies. They published it. And people became convinced that there was a problem. Okay. And in fact, it's now been done on thousands of galaxies. And most of them look like that. Not all of them, but most of them. Okay. So presumably, if there's justice in the world, which there is from time to time, one of these years Vera will get a Nobel Prize for that. And let's talk about why. Okay. So here's a clear contradiction between theory and observation. It's not small. It's striking. Okay? Newton's law of gravity plus Newton's law of motion is not working. Okay? Now, what are the options? And again, it's pervasive. Okay? It's almost every galaxy. Okay, I hear there is more mass.
You could ditch the law, make another one.
That's another option, good. So let's talk about options here. Okay, so option one, okay. There is more mass. Okay, option two, I want to just write what you like, which I love the phrasing, but I won't say ditch the law. The law is wrong. Okay, now, you all know that old song about I thought the law and the law won. Those are the two options. Okay, how is it an option that there is more mass? Suppose,
dark mass.
Yeah, well.
Or dark matter. Yeah.
Okay. Somebody else tell me more about this. Does anybody know about this first option?
Well, if you don't have put the right numbers, you won't get the right result.
Well, okay. So one, yeah.
If the first graph with a purple color is different, then the velocity curve would be also different.
Right. So supposing that actually there is a halo of invisible matter that the thing sits in. Invisible means gives off no light. Okay. Supposing that the thing that you see is like the, quote, tip of the iceberg, and it's actually sitting in the center of a big sphere of matter that gives off no light. Does the math work? Well, so now I'm free. Tell me if you can see this. I'm free to just change the matter density. Okay. Now, somebody already said it. You would not be surprised to learn that you can design the matter density to get the curve to go flat. In fact, the flat curve extends the velocity of the gas that the thing is sitting in has also been measured by radio telescopes using a similar technique. And the velocity of the gas is flat for a good way out past where the stars are. Yeah?
Your velocity curve only translate to the mass curve if you are using Euclidean space, right?
Yes.
Maybe space isn't Euclidean then.
Well, maybe space is not Euclidean. That's true. If space is not Euclidean, then, and in fact, space is not Euclidean because matter curves it. And you can use that effect, which is called gravitational lensing, that is, space acts like a lens. And if you look at a distant star or galaxy, you can see that it would be distorted as if passing through a lens. And that technique called gravitational lensing has been used to measure separately the distribution of masses of galaxies and the distribution of masses in clusters of galaxies. And indeed, the conclusion is that if general relativity is right, because now you have to use general relativity, okay, then there is more mass there than is lighting up, than is visible in stars, gas, and dust, which glow. By a factor of on the order of 10. Okay. So that's a very important technique called gravitational lensing. So you hit on something. And in the last few years, it's been used very successfully to trace the matter distribution. Okay. But that, of course, depends on another assumption, which is that general relativity gives the right bending of space from the mass. So if you buy general relativity, then that, however, agrees with these, roughly speaking, with these observations. Okay, so there is more mass. This is called dark matter. Does anybody know of any kind of matter that doesn't give off light?
Maybe some things that is neutrinos.
Maybe neutrinos.
Neutrinos.
Maybe neutrinos. Anything else?
Bosons?
Well, there's various kinds of bosons.
Graviton.
Okay. Graviton. The problem with gravitons is that they go the speed of light and they're not likely to form big clouds. You need something that itself has mass. A massless particle like a graviton or a photon, okay, won't sit still. You need something that has mass that will sit there and clump. And by the way, neutrinos only work if they have mass.
Is that but a particle? Black holes come from light and mass.
Okay. Black holes?
You could have very, very small black holes.
Like
black holinos? Black holes emit Hawking radiation, yes. But unless they're really small, it's hard to see because the temperature is very, very low. Okay? So not too small black holes. If they're the size of Mount Everest, they're glowing in gamma rays, and they would be seen. Okay? But the temperature goes down inversely like the mass. So if they're bigger than Mount Everest is about 10 to the 15 grams. And that turns out to be a convenient number we throw around. So they have to be bigger than Mount Everest, but otherwise. So the neutrinos have to have mass, I was just saying. But luckily, it's been observed, actually in Sudbury, does the best measurements of this, that neutrinos have mass. Or if I could say it's something new, some new particles. Okay? So that's one point of view. And I think that Cliff, who's doing one of these talks, will be telling you more about that idea. Okay? Let's talk about the other one. Okay. The law is wrong. Okay? There is a proposal for another law. Okay? This proposal makes no sense, but I'm going to tell it to you. Okay? This proposal is due to somebody called Milgram about 1982. At first, nobody took him seriously. His inspiration was another observation, which is the following observation. You might ask, supposing you decide to investigate this problem, you might ask, okay, what fixes when the velocity curve goes flat? That means there's some velocity which is characteristic of a star orbiting a galaxy. What determines that velocity? Okay, so for every galaxy, you can look, measure the light curve till you come to where it's flat. Okay? And you want to know, what is that? Is that correlate with anything? And it turns out that it does. This is not his discovery. This is a discovery of two people called Tully and Fisher. And Tully is usually in science, when two people discover something, you put their names in alphabetical order. So maybe Tully is not such a nice person. But they found the following, that if you measure the fourth power of the velocity to the fourth power, and you measure the total light, the total energy in light, so roughly speaking, the wattage of the galaxy, the amount of energy it puts forward, it puts out per second. Okay, the technical word for it is luminosity, total luminosity. They're proportional. The total luminosity goes like some constant times the velocity of the fourth power. And the data is pretty good that there's such a correlation. So, Mr. Milgram, or Dr. Milgram, reasoned as follows. Supposing the luminosity is proportional to the total mass of the galaxy. A natural assumption. The more mass in star, this is the, by the mass, this, we're not talking, there's no dark matter here. This is the other theory. So this is the total luminous mass. Okay? Then M goes proportional to velocity to the fourth power. Okay? Now, what could be governing that? Do you all know about dimensional analysis?
No.
Dimensional analysis is you figure out the units on each side and you use it to reason powerfully. And I'm going to show you an example of that. Okay? Now, how can we figure out what this constant is measured from the slope of this curve? But how can we think about it appropriately? What is it? Okay. Well, first, he said, clearly what should be relevant is not the mass, but the mass, the gravitational effect of the mass. So, you mean the units here? We're going to work it out in a minute.
Okay.
But first, he argued that, look, if I just increase the strength of gravity, that should increase the effect. Because what's influencing the stars moving is the gravitational force coming from the mass. So you should really put Newton's gravitational constant here. Because if you increase the mass, you make the stars go faster. But also, if you just increase the force of gravity, you make the stars go faster.
Okay.
So then there's a constant here. And you can work out what this constant is, the units of it. Okay. And does anybody want to do it?
Yeah.
Do we have 15 more minutes? And can I keep you the 10 times?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So so this is the constant which is measured in this. Can is anybody figure out what it is and tell me? The easy thing to give you a hint.
It's R.
Please?
I think it's R, isn't it?
No.
Okay.
The easiest thing is to think that gm over r squared is an acceleration.
Okay, it's maybe C.
No?
It's an acceleration.
Okay. And I'm going to call this a script A for an acceleration. Okay. Now, this acceleration is measured by the astronomers from this curve. Okay? From the slope of this curve, you get this relation. So now it's an equivalence. And this acceleration is measured, okay, from the astronomers. And I'm going to tell you what it is. Okay, A is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared. It's a tiny acceleration. If you see an insect, like a beetle crawling across the floor, okay, and you imagine that the insect doubles its speed in the lifetime of a dog, then that's that acceleration. Okay? Yeah.
I lost track. What is that deceleration of, again, a galaxy?
It's measured, it's not the acceleration of a galaxy, it's the slope of this curve divided by Newton's gravitational constant.
Maybe the least acceleration has a kind of an intrinsic acceleration of stars inside the galaxy.
I got one more trick for you. Okay? Let's go back. Let's go back to our formula for v squared over r. V squared, okay, I just shut that up there. I should have remembered that. V squared over r, okay, which is an acceleration. But remember now that v squared is constant. So now I want to find something about v squared. So this implies, if v squared is constant, then that implies that the acceleration is falling like 1 over r. So it implies that the acceleration must be some constant over r. Okay? Now, Newton's law says that the acceleration, which is the force, falls like 1 over r squared. If the velocity is a constant, it implies the acceleration that the stars feel as they go away from the center of the galaxy is falling like 1 over r rather than 1 over r squared. Right? Now, 1 over r is a lot bigger than 1 over r squared when r is big. So it implies that the gravitational force is stronger than Newton said it was, by quite a lot. Okay? Now, if you work out let me see what's the best way to jump here. Let me tell you what Milgram proposed now, and just put these things together. Okay? Here's Milgram's law. Okay? This is a proposal for changing the law. His law is, okay, work out what Newton's acceleration should be. So work out first the acceleration due to Newton. Okay? And there are two cases. So the acceleration due to Newton is gm over r squared for your star. Milgram says, supposing that that's greater than this magic acceleration A, okay, then the acceleration is the Newtonian acceleration. But supposing the Newtonian acceleration that's predicted is less than this magic acceleration A. Okay. So he's proposing a modification of Newton's law that applies when the accelerations are very small. Okay.
Special relativity.
No, nothing to do with special. Special relativity is when the velocities are large.
I know, so.
It's the opposite, sir. Yeah, sort of the opposite of special relativity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. If the acceleration is less than this magic value, okay, then Milgram proposes the acceleration goes like 1 over r rather than 1 over r squared, and the constant is gm times the magic acceleration. Another way to say that is that's the square root of the product of the Newtonian acceleration and the magic acceleration. You could unify the two formulas in one formula, but I don't need to explain the idea to you. Okay? And how you unify them turns out not to matter. Okay? So does everybody understand? Milgram proposes that when the acceleration is very small, there's a new law. And that new law matches the fact that the acceleration is going like a constant over r, which is what's observed, because that's the same thing as saying the velocity is constant as r increases. So the new law agrees with what's seen here and here, because where he got this is he then wrote b squared over r is the acceleration, is the square root of gm, the magic acceleration over r. He crosses out the r's, he squares this, and he gets v to the fourth is gm times the magic acceleration, which is what's observed by the astronomers here. Okay? So that's the null group's proposal. Okay, now, it conflicts with Newtonian mechanics, it conflicts with special relativity, it conflicts with general relativity. Okay? It's bizarre to have a force that falls off slower than one, than Newtonian forces fall off by 1 over r squared, electromagnetism, and gravity. Let me give you an idea why. Do you know the thing about thinking in terms of field lines?
Yeah.
Okay. And so why do forces, why does the electric force or the gravity force fall off like 1 over r squared? Because the field lines are conserved, and the force is the field lines per area, and the area of the sphere is growing like r squared. So that means that the force from field lines is falling like 1 over r squared. Okay. If the force falls more slowly than that, it means that you're getting more field lines as you go further away, which is bizarre. Right? Because if the field lines are the same, if they're conserved, and the force is the number of field lines per area, then the force should fall like 1 over r squared. If the force falls like 1 over r, it means the number of field lines piercing a sphere is growing as you go out from r. Okay? And that doesn't make any sense. And you can't write down easily, okay, simple versions of Newton's laws or general relativity that encompass this. Okay, so here are the two, I kind of messed it up, but there, remember there are the two competing ideas. There's dark matter, or there's a different force, which is, okay? The gravity, Newton's law is wrong, and there's a new law.
That lingers below can be concealed, can be put in general relativity in some way.
Is that an assertion or a question?
A question.
A question. Recently, people have been studying modifications of general relativity which might have Milgram's law in it. Okay? There are three such modifications available. One by John Moffat, who happens to be a colleague here in the building. Okay? One by Jacob Bekenstein, who is a very important theorist who invented the idea that black holes have entropy. Okay? The other one by somebody whose name I'm forgetting at the moment, who's in Connecticut. Okay? Each of them is really complicated. Okay? And each of them is really artificial. Okay? But it, quote, can be done and is being studied. Okay? Now, I want to finish, if you'll give me 5 or 10 minutes more. Since this is science, I want to show the data. And I hope I can remember how to do this. Select video source, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Okay, and I'm doing this in this way because I know that the Cliff doesn't know that I'm doing this, okay? But I know that Cliff is going to make a strong case that the right answer is dark matter because I know that's what he believes, okay? And that's what I believe about...
You're contradicting, right?
I'm not contradicting him, I'm just showing data. As I said before, okay, this theory of Milgram, this theory of Milgram makes no sense whatsoever. Yes?
In Milgram's law, what is the magic acceleration?
1.6 times 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared.
How do you know that's the magic acceleration?
Because it matches the slope of this relation that was down there.
Okay.
In fact, I'll start with, so this is data from a talk. I did not take the time, I hope you'll excuse me, to make you a separate presentation.
No.
There's all this I've said. You don't have to read any of the words. This is what I've said. The real measurement of the luminosity with the velocity is measured to be 3.9. The power is 3.9 plus or minus 0.2. So that could be 4. Okay. Here's the data. Here's a segment of the data. This has been measured. What they did here is they go to Ursa Major, where there's a collection of galaxies all at roughly the same redshift. So you can't blame errors on differences of redshift measurements. All these galaxies are in a cluster of galaxies at about the same redshift. And of course, scientists, to impress you, they measure everything in logs of things, because functions, powers become straight lines when you're measuring logs. So here is the log of the total luminosity in some, and they do this precisely in some frequency band. And here's the log of the velocity where the rotation curves go flat. And that line there is the fourth power. And there are many different measurements of this in different clusters of galaxies and so forth.
Okay.
I'm not going to give you the whole talk. I just want to show you some selected pieces of data. So here's a particular galaxy. Maybe we want to turn the lights down one. No, I wanted the other ones off. Whoops.
That's good.
Is that good? Okay. And is there something? Wait, wait. Okay. So okay, this is the first time this has been used. I can't believe it. Okay. This is a trademark thing. So this is this kind of picture here. Okay. But this is a real thing. This is the galaxy NGC 1560, which means it's in the New Galactic Catalog number 1560. Of somebody's catalog of galaxies, which I don't know. Okay, here is the radius from the center of the galaxy in kiloparsecs. A parsec is about 3 light years. A kilo is 1,000. So this is in thousands of light years times 3. Okay, here is the matter distribution as measured by looking at the stars and the gas. The gas also gives off light in the infrared and can be seen by infrared telescopes. Okay. Here is the prediction this theory is called Mon from modified Newtonian dynamics. That's what Milgram calls his theory. Okay. This red curve is the prediction where the input is this distribution of stars and gas, and the blue things are the data. Okay, not bad. Notice something, okay? Notice that where the matter distribution has a kink, so does the prediction of the theory, and so does the data. Okay? This fact that the data, these are the velocities of the stars, the fact that the data has a kink related to where the matter distribution has a kink suggests to some people that the matter distribution is the cause of the changes in velocity. And that's intuitive unless you believe that most of the matter is not shown here and is dark. If you think that this is due to dark matter, then then you have something to explain. So that's one galaxy. Okay, and of course, they show you the best cases first. Okay, and by the way, if you want to know the units are, this is in kilometers per second, if you want to get a sense of what the units for velocities of stars and galaxies is. It's on the order of 50-100 kilometers a second. Okay, and that's typically what the velocity of a star in our own galaxy. Okay, that's one case. Here's another case. Okay. A galaxy F563-1. What's interesting about this galaxy is that this is a kind of galaxy called a low luminosity galaxy. And these were galaxies which were only really studied after, in the last 10, 15 years, that is after Milgram made the theory. And again, the measurements are not quite so good, but here's the measurements of the velocities as you go out. Here's the distribution of gas, the distribution of stars, and here's the prediction. Okay? I'm not saying this theory is right. I don't know whether this theory is right, okay? But it fits a lot of data. Okay? There's a whole bunch of other galaxies. Here's the list of galaxies where it works. Here's the list of galaxies where the fit doesn't work so well. Okay? And they claim that there are no galaxies that really work badly. Okay? Now, I want 5 more minutes. One to tell you about one more piece of data, okay? And then I want to close. Okay? This is not the only case where Newton's laws are going badly. Okay? There is something called the Pioneer anomaly, which I had an anomaly in my spelling there. But the Pioneers are satellites. They were early satellites sent to explore the outer planets. Okay. There were 2 of them, 10 and 11, which went outside the solar system. Okay. They took data for something like 20, 25 years. That is, these satellites had radio transmitters, and they just transmitted data for 20 or 25 years, about half of that past the orbit of Saturn. They're now at 40, this is astronomical units, and they're now at sort of 40, 50 astronomical units when they gave out. Now, that's not now, but they gave out some years ago, transmitting data. They're still out there, but nobody's been able to receive from them. Okay. About 10 years ago, the people who watch these, who are at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, they had a program going where they were predicting where they should be, which is essential for tracking them. And what they did, they have a model of the solar system, a computer model with all the planets, asteroids, comets, everything that they can observe. And they put it into the model, and they predict the path of these satellites. And they predict in particular, the speed that they should be going. And each of them is going away from the sun in roughly opposite directions. And they found that they were not where they were supposed to be. And they, after thinking about it for a while, they found that there could be attributed to their having an anomaly, that is, they have less velocity than predicted. And this is a record of the anomaly, that is, when they subtract off the velocity they're predicted to have from using Newton's law, from the velocity they're observed to have, this is what's left over. For one, I don't know if this is Pioneer 10, but the same story is true for Pioneer 11. And this is the year in time, starting in 1986, going to 1984. They were launched in the 70s, I believe, but they didn't have data before 1986 because they switched the computers that they and NASA used, and the old data was on a kind of magnetic tape that could not be read by any computer that they still own. Which is a problem that they have recently fixed. They had to build new magnetic tape readers and write new software for them and so forth. So this is where the data they could read starts. And you see that the change in velocity is increasing over time. Now, when the change in velocity is increasing over time, what does that mean? That means there's acceleration, and there's a constant acceleration. So, and this is a graph of the acceleration, which is unexplained. This is the distance from the sun in astronomical units. An astronomical unit is a radius of the Earth's orbit. Okay. Some of the dots are pioneered. The black dots are pioneered 10, 11, and the white dots are pioneered 11. Okay. And they both trace the same acceleration, which is a constant acceleration, which is unexplained. So both satellites appear to be feeling an acceleration, which is unexplained, which is constant. And what's the value of this acceleration that they're seeing? The value can be measured, and I'll call this A pioneer. Okay. And it's roughly 8. Is it somewhere on the slide? I don't remember if it's 8 point something. Okay. It's roughly 8 times 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared. Okay. Not far from Milgram's acceleration, which is 1.2 times 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared. 1.6. I could even have one of those. It could be one. I apologize. It could be one. Do you want me to find out whether it's 1.2 or 1.6? It would be 1.2. I apologize. So this is 8.6 and this is 1.2. Okay. Okay. Let me turn the lights back on and conclude, because everybody's, I'm sure, hungry. Okay? These are both experimental anomalies. Okay. And let me summarize them. Okay? Whatever is causing the rotations of stars and galaxies to go constant, whether it's dark matter or a change in the laws or something else, okay, there's a very simple law that captures the data. And this astronomers agree with. Almost nobody believes that this is true fundamentally, because it makes no sense for the reasons I said. Okay. But we agree it captures the data in a simple way. And we're very puzzled. If there is really dark matter, as Cliff will argue, dark matter has to explain this law, and in particular, it has to explain where this acceleration comes from, which is in the data. This number is in the data, read off the data. Where does that come from? The pioneer, and this has been seen now in hundreds and hundreds of galaxies, and this is, you can't say it's experimental error. The pioneer still could be experimental error. It's just two satellites. Okay. It's true that they're going in different directions from the sun, okay, but it's just two satellites, and they were built and observed by the same laboratory and the same group of people. So it's always possible hitting somewhere in Jet Propulsion Laboratory is a programming error in how they analyze the data. Or that they've racked their brains about this, or the two satellites have some gas leak or something like that away from the sun. And they have really, they've rebuilt models of them, they've studied everything they can study. They can't find a mistake in the construction. They can't find the mistake in the analysis of the data, but it's always possible it's there, because I'm sure you know from your own experiences that mistakes are really hard to find. Okay? But if it's real, okay, it means that even in the solar system, Newton's law is not exactly right. Okay?